like that, no matter how exhausted I was, or how little I drank before collapsing. I tossed and turned under my thin blanket, hoping I could fall back asleep, but my bladder was insistent. So I cursed quietly, threw the blanket aside, and clambered out of the wagon. As I expected, most of our makeshift camp was asleep, some in the handful of wagons, but most in small wedge tents or huddled masses around the campfires that had died out. There were plenty of guards posted around the perimeter, and I knew Captain Kilcoyne had mounted men screening the countryside to alert us of any hostile advances. Still, even with those assurances, it was peculiar to walk among a sleeping camp. All these violent men in repose, the entire camp silent. A few Sildoon who were guarding a line of picketed horses saw me, one nodding, the other two ignoring me. And again, I was reminded that soldiering seemed to be nine parts boredom, waiting, training, erecting or pulling down camps, tedious chores, moving, and one part horrible, sudden, and irrevocable violence. I shivered and headed into a thicket of reeds. I was unlacing my hosen when I looked down the small incline towards the placid lake and saw a lone figure there along the shore, still as stone. After relieving myself, I nearly walked back towards the wagon to get back under the covers, hoping for one more blessed hour of sleep before Braelar gave the command to pack up and get moving again. But as usual, my curiosity got the better of me, just as often as my bladder. I walked towards the lake, wondering who else found it as fascinating as I did. As I got closer, I should have guessed. Even with everything in shades of gray, I saw moonlight glinting off the tines of the Rancer. That should have stopped me immediately and sent me back up the hill, but for some reason, my feet kept me moving forward. Sofjian surely heard my footfalls and the tiny cascade of pebbles, but didn't seem especially alarmed or concerned. She was also much better at guessing. Still facing the water, she said, "My brother does have a talent for finding lonely locales, and you seem to have a habit of meeting Memrodons in the dark of night. I would curb that if I were you." That seemed designed to drive me off, and should have really, but failed. I took a few more hesitant steps, knowing I wouldn't have too many opportunities to speak with her without arousing suspicion or animosity among the Sildoon. "No, you Memrodons are dangerous, to be certain. But I don't think I was the only one surprised that Skilana threw in her lot with the Emperor like that." "No," she replied, smiling ever so slightly. "But you were the only one to be seduced by her. Or were you hoping it was the other way around?" I felt my face flush as I stammered, "There wasn't any. She didn't seduce me. It was only a kiss. One. Singular. How did you—" "Your boyish infatuation wasn't lost on anyone with half a brain, which means I was the only one who likely noticed. So I hazarded a guess."
You didn't know?"
"Not until now. How interesting, though hardly shocking. Skilana won many people over with her plucky charm. Why should an over-trusting boy prove any different? But you are right about that. It turns out she was far more devious than anyone suspected." She snapped her wrist and made a stone skip across the waveless water, just as her brother had. "So, young scribe, back to our original point. I have to confess I am surprised you sought me out here, clearly not driven by romance this time. Why are you not abed, as you obviously should be?"
"I was about to ask you the same. I came out to... well, it doesn't matter. But not seeking anyone out, that's for certain. I saw you down here, and was curious. Are you riding out now?"
She dragged the butt spike of her pole arm through the gravelly sand,
flicking some out into the water, resulting in more of a plonking sound than any kind of splash. The water was heavy indeed. Soon, I wanted to look at this very unusual lake once before I did, though. I'd heard rumors of it before, but never had cause to visit. She turned and faced me, grounding the rancor in the loose soil. "But you did not come down here to ask after my sleeping habits, or to discuss peculiar lakes, did you? If you have more to say, do so now. Otherwise, leave me in peace." Yes, they were family. I consider that coming down here might not have been the wisest course for any number of reasons, and nearly excused myself to rush back to the wagon. But here I was, and the opportunity was there as well. "Captain Kilcoyne told me about your father, how he was murdered, and how he, your brother that is, how he fled when your priest called on you to attend him in the dead room." While she had been flitting around amusement before, a mask seemed to slide into place as she said, flatly, "Did he?" I pressed on. "He did, though the thing that struck me was, it sounded as if you two were close. Closer, anyway. Which surprised me, given your relationship now." "Oh, and how would you quantify our relationship now, scribe?" After thinking about it for a moment, I replied, "Severed, or severe, I'm still trying to figure it out, but unpleasant for sure." That actually earned a laugh, but it was short and clipped and harsh around the edges. "I do so appreciate your forthrightness. Remarkable. And so to my brother's flight from the dead room, well, it must be so very painful to admit that your sister is stronger. I am surprised that he chose to reveal even that much. How very loquacious and generous of him. And what else did my brother say?" "Not much," I admitted. "He stopped there." "As well he would. It is one thing to admit some failure of courage, permissible in one so young, expected even. But the subsequent failures, revenge unfulfilled, that's one thing. Again, feckless youth can be blamed. But an entire people betrayed? No, that admission doesn't flow out of the mouth so easily, does it?" I thought of a way to dip the question in honey, but then simply replied, "How were your people betrayed? What is it you think he did?" She pulled the rancor out of the stones and sand as if yanking it from the body of a fallen foe, and then laid the haft on her shoulder. "Not think, know for a certainty. And you will need to ask him that, scribe. I do wonder what he will tell you. Now I have miles to ride and trails to clean." She started up the incline, towards the camp. I was tired, and fought off a yawn. But I knew if I held off recording the latest entry and tried to sleep any more, the details would be lost come dawn. So I sighed and headed back to the wagon, resigned to lighting the lamp and uncorking some ink again. Chapter 5. I fell asleep sitting up, quill still in hand, my head leaning against the wooden rib that held up the canvas frame, and was jostled awake the next morning as I felt the wagon shift into motion, and heard the familiar sounds that told me our company was on the move again. The creak of the axle, chains rattling overhead, pots jostling each other, the clomp of the horses' hooves all around us, men shouting orders up and down the line. And of course, Braylar calling me out, "Attend me, Arky." I made my way to the front of the wagon, hunchwalking as ever, dodging the swinging pots and tools, and climbed over the bench awkwardly as the wagon rolled over a rut and nearly sent me tumbling. He said, "I would have thought you'd have mastered that by now, archivist. You've spent more time in a wagon than most drovers." I took the dried goat he offered and stifled a yawn as the captain added, "And little better at getting rest when the opportunity affords itself. I assume you were up working. Any progress last night?" I confessed that the forays into journals and scrolls and ledgers hadn't proved revealing, beyond some oblique references to things I'd already uncovered, The captain nodded, clearly expecting that, but no less irritated to hear it.
Very well. Sup on our fine road fare, wash it down with some watery ale or equally watery wine, the choice is yours, and get back to your pens then.
I continued chewing, working the meat from one side of my mouth to the other like sinewy cud. At least it makes the ale taste good. Or the wine, that's something.
Braylar allowed himself a tiny smile that wasn't burdened by a twitch, but lasted so short a time it was easy to imagine it was merely a trick of the morning shadows.
I find your cheery disposition endlessly entertaining, Arky. I do wonder, though, if you will be able to maintain it, in the face of what you witness and partake of.
I hope you can, but it would be disingenuous of me to say I expect it, and I do know how you loathe falsehood.
I almost feel some semblance of guilt for having lured you away from your quiet and tempest-free life.
I lifted the flask, drinking old wine that had a nasty vinegar bite to it, and swallowed the meat cud, trying not to choke. I considered Vinduro wrestling with his grief, and the difficult task of relaying the news of Gleswick's death to the widow and children, and how his walk, his stature, had changed. Was it irrevocable? Would he ever recover the spring in his step, or the carefree demeanor, having lost his best friend and being increasingly more burdened with more responsibilities and witness to more loss? Why should I prove any different? Loy dying in my arms, killing not only one man, but now more, being betrayed by Skilana. I said,
You told me not so very long ago that having tasted a touch of grief, I was that much closer to living a complete life. Perhaps I'm just further along the road now.
He gave me a long, evaluating look, then shook his head once.
I do say quite a lot of things.
And many decidedly untrue or manipulative, but not that one. You spoke true, didn't you?
Braylar flexed a gloved hand, the leather stretching and creaking, and leaned back against the bench.
You are young still, but not daft. There are many cruel truths in life. I spoke but one. When you know what you can endure, then, and only then, do you know what you are capable of.
He reached into a bag and handed me a wedge of cheese. Now, fill your belly and get back to work.
He stopped as he spotted a horseman riding hard down the road towards us, hooves kicking up dust. I assumed it was a scout returning, but the haste didn't bode well at all.
Braylar stopped the team and called out behind us orders to halt, which were relayed down the line.
When the Sildoon reined up and saluted, red-faced, sweaty, and staring straight ahead, suspicions were confirmed. He was loath to deliver his news.
Report, Braylar ordered.
The scout remained rigid in the saddle.
Skrina sighted a big company closing in on us, Cap. Two, in fact. North, and a little further northwest.
Well, that is not welcome news, is it?
How many in each?
Screeners didn't give an exact count, Cap, but...
An estimate, then.
The scout looked as uncomfortable as you could just relaying information, but his posture didn't melt in the slightest.
More than us, for certain. Twice as many. In each company, Cap. Aglovians, the one directly ahead looks to be Governor Pinchurk's, and the one northwest.
Yes, yes, Governor Weslick's. Thank you for the geography lesson. And how far away?
Half a day. A little more, maybe.
Braylar scowled.
Dismissed. Rest yourself and your horse, Sildoon. Send another back down the road to fetch the screening party.
The soldier nodded and saluted again.
Aye, Cap.
He rode down past our wagon quickly, clearly relieved to be relieved.
I asked, How did they prepare such forces so quickly?
Braylar turned and snapped at me.
Memrodons can send messages in an instant. Not all of them shred people's minds like my sweet sister. Our supreme advantage in intelligence is but one reason the Sildoon have been a superior army on nearly every battlefield we have tromped across. Only now, they are no longer working in our interests, are they?
Vindouro and the massive Asmorgon rode up alongside us, with Muldus pitched at an odd angle in his saddle behind and Hughspear next to him.
Muldus said, "Telling you, you shouldn't be in the plaguing saddle, you old goat. Holy elves, you just got husked. You ought to be resting."
Hughspear's eyes were a little sunken, and there was a waxy sheen to his skin, but he sat the saddle better than Muldus, back straight, and had an uneven smile.
"While your concern is amusing, I've napped long enough."
"Plague me. I want you in a wagon so I don't have to hear your smacking gums, you wrinkled ass."
Braelar gave Hughspear a long, appraising look.
"I'm very glad to see you among us again, Lieutenant. Glad indeed."
Then he looked at the other officers.
"I do hate to ruin a good reunion, but you all saw the scout, no doubt?"
"That we did,"
Muldu slurred, and immediately looked furious that his mouth was still betraying him.
"Bad?"
"Certainly not good. The Aglovians are out in force ahead of us."
Vindouro asked, "Too many to take on, expecting?"
"You expect right," the captain said. "We will not engage unless we have to. I didn't break free of Sunrak only to let the men die in the wild."
As Morgan boomed,
"Sure would like to take on somebody somewhere. Yeah, maybe they weren't the ones that laid into us and killed our brothers on the bridge, but they're aligned with those whore sons. Leopards, Andurians, Aglovians, no matter. Like to make somebody bleed a lot of blood. Lot of blood."
"Yeah, ours,"
Muldus replied, again siding with the captain so long as someone else seemed to be opposing him.
"Cap says we change course, we change course."
As Morgan dwarfed Muldus, no easy task, and even his huge stallion looked like a pony underneath him.
"You telling me you don't want to cut up some witches' mushrooms?"
Muldus urged his horse closer and laid his hand on the hilt of his falchion.
"Keep calling me that. Go on. One good arm is all I need, you ogre fuck."
Braelar slapped the side of the bench.
"We do not bloody ourselves, and we don't throw our lives away simply in the name of misbegotten revenge. When the time and place is right, we will cut them deep. But that will be ground of our choosing, and when the odds are in our favor. For now, we veer west and work around the Aglovians."
Hughspear waved at some gnats, doing no good at all.
"I imagine they have some Memmerdons in their company, Captain?"
He said this nonchalantly, as if he hadn't had his brains nearly melted the last time we all saw him in the saddle. Braelar nodded slowly.
"They likely do, so they will report our movements for certain to the Imperials. But we have mobility as the advantage for now."
I wondered what he meant by that, since we had so many supply wagons that slowed our convoy down considerably, but it didn't seem prudent to ask just then, as he announced,
"We head back south, then west, slip past them."
I heard Sofjian's voice coming up behind us. "That would likely prove a very bad idea, brother." Everyone turned and looked and saw the Memmerdon with three soldiers, one of them Benk, looking none too happy to be accompanying Sofjian again. Braelar said, irritation smoldering,
"And why is that, sister?"
She smiled at Hughspear.
"So, not dead then? That at least is some good news."
"How many? How far?" Braelar asked.
Sofjian pointed a long finger at Benk.
"I saw the young Sildoon here on their way to you, in a hurry from the looks of it. I accompanied and asked this one very nicely to explain the urgency."
Braelar said, irritation flaming higher.
"So forthright, my men."
Benk colored up.
"The we—"
He stopped himself, cleared his throat, and tried again.
"The mem here, your sister, I mean. Real persuasive. I hurried, though.
Why, of course you did. And what is the news, then?
Bank looked at the other two soldiers, and then replied.
There's a large company of Aglovians coming in from the west. Big one. 300 or 400.
Braylar drummed his gloved fingers on the bench.
How many miles apart are they from the other forces, and how distant from us? Is it possible for us to slip between them?
Bank looked at the other scout and shrugged.
What do you think? 12 miles, maybe?
Hughspear said,
If they have Memrodons, as seems likely, then slipping between or past doesn't seem viable.
The captain looked at his sister.
And to the south?
Sofjin replied,
Near on 1,000, half a day, and there was no time to clean all your tracks. Go west or south, and you go to your death and destruction.
Braylar slapped his thigh.
Well, as appealing as destruction sounds, it appears we have no choice. I have heard enough. East it is.
Maldus looked around at everyone, waiting for someone else to object, and when no one did, took it upon himself.
East, Cap. Nothing that way except for the God Vale, and that ain't any kind of way at all.
Before Braylar could reply, though, Sofjin did.
Astute, as ever, but my brother is right. Our only chance is to slip around the Aglovians and then continue north again.
Maldus glared at her, and with one eyelid sagging, it was hard to tell if that enhanced or diminished the effect.
We'll be penned in, and I wasn't speaking to you anyway, witch.
Braylar wrapped Bloodsounder's haft on the wagon bench to reclaim their attention.
We are penned in now. It is a broad enclosure at the moment, but they are clearly coordinating, and that pen closes in tighter every moment we delay.
Alert the troops. We go east, not to the God Vale, but east until we are clear.
As Morgan, Maldus, and the scouts rode off one way, and Sofjin another. The captain sighed, and then looked at Hughspear closely.
I have seen men felled by Memrodons who never recovered. So it is something of a miracle that you are in the saddle at all. I must say, you do look much better than expected, Hugh. Is that deceptive?
Hughspear smiled.
I do not profess to be fully healed, Captain. There is some dizziness, some nausea. But no, I am in much better condition than Maldus.
I need you alert, competent, and capable, yes? Can you do this, Hugh? Tell me true. If not, the best thing you can do for all of us is to heed the advice of your crass nurse mother and get some rest.
Hughspear nodded, the coins in his beard clacking.
I will not do my duties unless I am confident I can ably perform them, Captain. I'm well.
Braylar smiled.
Very good. See to it, then.
Hughspear saluted smartly in that twisting, odd way the Saldoon had.
Aye, Captain. I will ascertain what we need from the scouts.
He held himself erect as he turned his horse about, but I suspected he had to be keenly and acutely feeling the after-effects of Ruzjenna's attack.
Vinduro must have been thinking the same thing. Got to say, glad to see him up and moving and all, but...
The captain glowered as only he was capable of.
He is as forthright as they come. And not half so mulish as Maldus. Hughspear will do nothing to endanger the men. If he says he is fit, and there's an end to it.
Aye, Cap.
Vinduro rode back towards the rest of the soldiers as well. I looked at Braylar and couldn't help gulping as I asked,
Captain, if we get trapped against the...
The God Vale is my concern. Translating is yours. Back to it, Arky.
I climbed back in and tried to focus on my job. Our convoy changed direction, and we rolled over the uneven terrain. While it wasn't as hilly as it had been in the first stretch of Aglovia, it was a far cry from the flat plains of Anjuria. The captain wasn't interested in any company at all, even silent company, and ordered me back into the wagon to continue translating.
He didn't add, while there was still time, but then again, he didn't have to. Escape wasn't looking promising, and he had made it clear that we were not going to surrender. I tried very hard to focus on the worn pages in front of me, hoping to distract myself from envisioning mad charges to our doom, but I found myself rereading the same passages over and over again. Hours passed by, and I made only halting progress. It didn't help that most of the recent documents were exceedingly dull and mundane. More lay subsidies, catalogs of public works by some priest of truth or another, and endless inventories of larders documenting depleted this or that at one temple or another. Even worse were manorial or baronial records and other texts written by secular parties, as there was almost no likelihood of encountering anything related to Myrmidons, frames, cursed weapons, or anything else of interest. Still, I pressed on. But it was so odd to be reading the most boring tomes ever drafted, while every mile likely brought us closer to obliteration. When we broke to feed and water the horses, I took the opportunity to get out of the stifling wagon and stretch my legs and clear my head. I saw Hugh Spear standing alone in a field, running his palm across the very top of the feather grass as it blew gently in the dry breeze. I wasn't certain if he preferred to be alone, but in my experience, the only way to be certain was to ask. I approached, and when he heard me, he turned and favored me with a smile. He still looked waxy and tired, and more bowed than usual, but his eyes were alert. I said, "How do you fare, Hugh Spear?" The tall lieutenant replied, "I am alive, Arky, and that always beats the alternative." "So it does. What I meant to ask was, how am I recovering from having my mind nearly torn apart? Ruse Jenna wasn't able to complete her attack, thanks to the captain, which is the only reason I'm alive at all. All things considered, I'm actually remarkably well, in truth." He reached up and tapped a long finger against his temple. "Some physicians at your university surely studied our brains, but so far as I've ever gleaned, no one has much of an idea of how things work up here. I'm not even sure Myrmidons do. And they alone have the ability to deconstruct, dissect, and distress what the gods saw fit to give men for minds. It is an awesome and terrible power, and I'm glad I was not cursed with it. More glad still I was not blasted apart by it. I am better off than Muldus, as it happens." He looked immeasurably sad, saying that. "An admission that leaves me feeling unsettled. And guilty." I'd never really considered it in that light before. I glanced back at the convoy and then said, "Can I ask you something?"
"But of course, young scholar."
I said, "It's clear why memory mages have been feared and hunted for millennia whenever they were foolish enough to be discovered, and why some priests in All Sildoon have sought to control them. They are terrifying, or at least intimidating. But I can't help notice that even before Ruse Jenna, Muldus harbored a very special hatred for Myrmidons. Why is that exactly?" The older officer turned to me slowly. I thought he might not answer at all when he finally replied,
"I would suggest you pose that question directly to him, but we both know how that would likely end.
With me on my back, gasping for air, or with his boot on my chest." Hugh Spear smiled.
"An accurate assessment. So I won't point you in his direction. But you must never mention that I told you this, or mention it at all, really. Because a boot on your chest would be as good as it got. Understood?"
"Understood," I replied.
"Good. Walk with me for a bit, then."
We moved off further away from the company, and Hugh Spear said,
"You recall the manumission ceremony in Sunrak?"
"The hangings? Yes, it's sort of seared in my memory. Nearly impossible to forget that."
"True. and doubly so when you are directly involved. I was witness to Maldus's ceremony, standing in the small crowd of jackals, and this particular manumission was tragically similar to the one you yourself were witness to. Only both Memurdons seemed to struggle that day. It was clear from the start that someone would choke to death, possibly several someones.
I meant to ask about that, Hugh Spear.
Hugh is fine, Aki.
Nodding, I said, Hugh, then, why do the Sildoon hang all the men at once? Why not one at a time, so that there is less chance of the Memurdons allowing one to strangle to death?
He continued walking at a leisurely pace. An astute question. While there are some who posit that those recruits whom they sense will be hardest to bond with must be brought closer to death, that still doesn't entirely answer why they don't do them singly. The answer is terribly Sildoonian, I am afraid.
Which is?
The manumission does have an element of gruesome pageantry to it, but it isn't simply for show, or even a ritual. For those slaves who elect to stay, to become full-fledged members of the Tower from that day forward, it is important they understand the weight of that decision, as well as the inherent dangers. They all accept the noose, knowing that there is a chance, however small, that they could die at the end of it, moments later.
So this ensures that no one stays without seriously mulling over the consequences?
Correct. It is a decision that will impact the rest of their lives, whether that proves to be decades or moments. They don't want anyone in the Tower who has not pledged their body and heart to the Tower mates and the survival and success of the Tower itself.
I shook my head slightly. That does make a rather terrible sort of sense. So that day, when Maldus was hung, someone died? Or someone's?
Hugh Spear stopped walking. Yes, two, in fact. But it was the boy alongside Maldus, closest to the center, the last to hang, that scarred him.
I was suddenly wondering about the wisdom of pursuing this questioning at all.
He was close to the boy?
Hugh Spear nodded.
Aye, recruits are brought to the Empire from the hinterlands on all sides. Many have nothing in common at the start, possessing a variety of cultural trappings. Most don't speak the same language. But after 10 years, they develop a kinship, a brotherhood, that is tougher than the best forged steel. And nowhere was this more evident than between Maldus and Vrilan. I watched the two of them, and while the pair hated each other at first, no doubt too similar in hating the reflection, they grew to become closer than any two people I can recall seeing.
Under the gruff, belligerent, crass exterior, I suspected there was something more relatable. Hugh Spear continued.
So when Vrilan went purple and dropped, Maldus was the first there to rip the noose free, and the first to know it was too late. The boy was dead.
Yes, some questions were better left unasked. I can see how that would do it.
Yes, to be fair, Maldus never liked the Memurdons before. His clan had hunted memory witches to near extinction time and time again in his land. But seeing his truest friend die because of their slowness or negligence? Yes, that branded his heart with an unwholesome hatred that has cooled little to this day.
I had trouble imagining a connection with another person like that.
That's tragic. I can't even fathom. But at the same time, it's the Towers themselves that order the Memurdons to perform this ceremony, correct? Aren't they more responsible, really?
Hugh Spear started heading back in the direction of the convoy.
Oh, indeed, that is the truth. But grief isn't always beholden to the truth, and is not especially fond of gradient or distinctions of subtlety. Maldus pledged his life to the jackals the day he was hung and saved. He couldn't very well assign them responsibility. He blamed the Memurdons then, and willed to the end of his days.
I nodded. I can understand that, truly. But what you just said brings up another point.
Vreeland himself chose to be hung, knowing full well the risks that something could go horribly wrong. As you mentioned, that's part of the severity of the choice, risking your life for the promise of more, when you could simply walk away with less. But the surety that you will in fact walk away. Surely Muldus can't blame the Myrmidons completely. Can he? Hughspear gave a small, sad smile. Oh, I am sure he harbors some resentment for his dead comrade. He does have an impressive capacity for anger. But while the dead can make good scapegoats, they make poor targets for bile and bubbling hatred. Especially when the Myrmidons and their multitudes are very much alive. He looked down at me and said, Which is precisely why I tell you to never speak to him of this. You think you have seen him in a state before? Ha! That is nothing at all. The years cool passions for some men, neutralize poison, soften the edges of grief and rage and prejudice. But for others, they hold on even tighter to the things that burn their insides out, regardless of the passage of time, or even in spite of it, as if to curse the very world itself. Muldus is such a one. He started back towards the camp. Be grateful you have a moderate temperament and keen appreciation for subtlety. I hope they are never tested. Thank you for the walk. After relieving myself, I returned to the wagon, opened my case, and began again, despairing of ever finding anything else remotely useful to anyone. But I delved into a small book with a warped wooden cover, and finally came across some passages that caught my interest. It was another account by an underpriest of truth, Santrizo. There was nothing immediately arresting. Various descriptions of his duties and excursions to various villages in the vicinity of his temple. But Santrizo mentioned more than once an acute curiosity for those things arcane. He chastised himself for it on more than one occasion, admitting that he would likely only bring down the wrath of the order by pursuing that line of thinking. And yet, he seemed drawn to all things peculiar or beyond the pale. I pressed on, excited again to be translating something that appeared to be leading somewhere. 3 hours later, I was nearly done recording and making notes, and couldn't fight a smile off my face. Finally, something noteworthy to share again. And that's when Braelar called me back to the bench. I pulled the canvas flap aside and started to throw my leg over when he looked up and said,
No, span the crossbow and then take your seat here, along with a quiver.
I looked ahead and saw a village coming into view. It was larger than the plague village we'd occupied near Deadmoss, but not much. Though this one was clearly not deserted, as I saw several villagers running from the olive trees, dropping their baskets as they fled down the road towards their homes. Are we riding through the village?
We are. Cross thatch.
Why? I asked, suddenly as worried as if we'd just run across the entire Imperial army.
Because that's where the road happens to go, which is where wagons go when they wish to travel, which is what we are doing. Now span that bolter and be quick about it.
I wiped an ink-stained hand across my brow, mopping up sweat with my sleeve, and did as commanded. When I stepped over and joined him on the bench, careful not to accidentally knock the trigger and discharge the bolt, I asked, Do you want the blanket to cover the crossbow? Before realizing the absurdity of the question, as we couldn't blanket an entire convoy, Never mind. He stopped whatever rebuke he had in mind and nodded.
Simply have the crossbow at the ready, casual but visible. Villagers do not pose a threat. They will likely hole up in their hovels until we pass. But one can never be too careful.
It was better than a battalion blocking our way, but I still felt uneasy, and more so as we approached the outskirts and the first few buildings. While a fair number of villagers might indeed have been hiding, many were out and staring openly at the convoy as it rolled up. A large party of villagers were walking down the road towards us, and every whitewashed house with thatched roofs we passed revealed more of them standing and watching, their hosen rolled down to their knees, broad straw hats everywhere, dirty linen, lean figures, spare and sinewy. Most were holding some agrarian instrument or other, sickles, scythes, pitchforks. While they couldn't be blamed for holding the tools of their craft, I found it hard to believe they had all been using them just then. And they did not look especially welcoming. Braelar halted the wagon, and his lieutenants rode up on either side, along with Sofjian, her Rancer propped on the shoulder of her scale cuirass. Casual, but threatening. Muldus was just next to me, and pointed at a burly man in the group approaching, who was holding a staff longer than he was, with two iron loops at the top and a shorter, stout bar hanging down.
"Now that there is a proper flail, Cap."
And he laughed, but his mouth made it sloppy. Captain Kilcoyne ignored him, eyes locked onto a short figure in the middle of the small band in finer clothes than the rest. He had a bald pate, gray hair that looked like horse mare glued to his skull that fell to his shoulders, and a sober expression on his pocked face. The leader of the welcome party said,
"Name's Felburn, the mayor of Crossthatch. Folks hereabouts call me Mayor Fell on account of that. Hard to figure, but there it is."
Braelar nodded once.
"Well met, Mayor Fell. I am Captain Braelar Kilcoyne."
"Sort of had a hunch you would say that. See, word arrived just yesterday that there was a big party of Sildoon in the territory here. Might pass through, might not. Led by one Captain Kilcoyne. Jackal Tower, am I right?"
"You are indeed," Braelar turned to me. "You see, no finer intelligence and communication talent in the world than the Empire's."
He looked at Mayor Fell again.
"I imagine, then, that this messenger might have also mentioned that we are in quite a hurry. Given that we are fugitives now, it is a relatively new status, so it still rolls off the tongue strangely. But there it is."
Mayor Fell smiled, tight and small.
"Aye, word was you were deserters." "And how do you feel about that, Fell? I do hope you aren't thinking of trying to apprehend us."
The mayor shook his head.
"No, nothing like that. Imperial squabbles, well, those are for you and yours. We're clearly no soldiers. Or fools. Won't be trying to stop you. I just came out to tell you we want no trouble is all."
Braelar looked around at the scattered populace of Crossthatch.
"That's good to hear. And yet, I cannot help but notice a surprising amount of shears and scythes and pitchforks, and why yes, that man there does indeed have an impressive flail."
He laughed.
"That sort of thing tends to attract trouble, Mayor Fell."
The mayor looked a little sheepish.
"I told the folks that much as well, but I ain't emperor, just a humble mayor. And my people, well, they felt real uncomfortable letting a big armed party come riding through without making some show of being able to defend themselves if it came to it."
He extended his own hands, open, palms up.
"Course, I tried explaining that if you came through with evil in your hearts, a show of spades weren't like to dissuade you. We're simple folk, but proud. So there it is."
Braelar started to reply, when we heard hoofbeats, coming fast. A rider came up on our right, reining in right before the captain, the Sildoon breathing fast, the horse frothy around the muzzle, its chest pumping.
"Report."
The soldier said, "Big company coming in hard, Cap. 400-500. He continued panting.
"How far?"
"Mile, maybe less. We missed them. Came out of an abandoned quarry, south of here, looks like."
Braelar's eyes narrowed, and he grabbed the crossbow from my hands, turning back to the mayor.
"How much do they offer you to delay us?"
The mayor was backing up, holding up his hands, shaking his head.
"We had to—"
The crossbow bolt in the chest stopped him short, and he fell over backwards, his plea severed.
"Pity you won't get to spend it.
The crossbow hit me in the stomach, and I reached for the quiver to reload it, when Braelar shouted and got the team moving again. The villagers ahead of us jumped out of our way and ran for cover of the buildings as crossbow bolts began to fly as the convoy picked up pace. I looked to my left and saw a small girl peering up over the edge of a window. A bolt slammed into the adobe a foot away, and she ducked back down. We rode hard through the remainder of the village, brick and clay buildings flying past, but didn't encounter any resistance. The road curved to the east, and we rounded a barn where we nearly slammed into a hastily assembled blockade of barrels and wagons and cairns. Braelar halted the troops as the dust the horses and wheels had kicked up billowed ahead of us.
30 men, off horses, and move this shit out of our way, now!
Muldus and Asmorgon echoed the order, and Sildoon dismounted and ran forward, cursing and shouting as they shoved and pushed everything aside. Braelar slammed the heel of his hand on the bench.
I wish I had time to burn this humble little village to the ground.
Sofjian rode alongside, waving her hand in front of her face as she coughed on some of the dust.
How is the fugitive life treating you so far, brother? Even the farmers have turned against us. What next? The weather?
He swore at a soldier struggling with a barrel and said to his sister,
You do well to remember that our fate is yours as well.
Oh, it isn't lost on me, Bray.
The captain hit me in the arm.
Span it, boy.
I shifted the lever forward to release the claws, dropped the bolt in place, and folded the devil's claw back onto the stock. An arrow thunked into the side of our wagon, and another struck the wall of a building to our right, plaster flying. Everyone looked around, and one Sildoon saw the attacker in the loft of a barn, spun in his saddle, and loosed a bolt. It missed wide, but frightened the archer enough that he ducked down. When he rose back up to take another shot, two more bolts didn't miss, both striking him in the chest. The soldiers had most of the debris clear when I heard shouting from behind us. A moment later, another Sildoon rode up.
Nearly to cross thatch now, Cap.
Braelar stood and bellowed,
Enough! Mount up!
Most Sildoon ran back to their horses, and a few pushed a final wagon aside. The captain got our team moving, and we lurched forward, maneuvering around a small cart, the side of our wagon smashing against a barrel as we passed. And then we were through, several Sildoon riding ahead of us through the last of the village as the rest of the convoy followed our wagon. No more villagers challenged us, and it looked like we would be back on the dirt road and on the move again, when one of the advance screeners returned. Braelar slowed the team enough to hear him.
What now?
The long-faced Sildoon replied.
Got us a big problem, Cap. War wagons ahead, nearly set up, about ready to link the final chains, looks like. 20, 30 maybe. Pickets of cavalry on the perimeter. There's a ravine to the east, not a pure blockage, but real snug.
Vindoro was riding next to us and said,
Plague me. It's like they knew we was heading this way. Sprung the trap good.
Braelar considered for a moment, then asked,
Memrodons?
Longface said,
Didn't see any, but like Sergeant Venn said, they knew we was coming. Got to figure they got at least one in tow.
Braelar said,
Very well.
He turned to Muldus, Huspear, and Asmorgon, who all reined up.
War wagons linking ahead. Ready the men. Loose what bolts we can, but no one is to engage. Is that understood? We force our way past, then ride hard for the north.
They said, Aye, Cap, almost in unison, and turned their horses about before heading back down the line and relaying the order. Braelar turned to me.
We are about to head directly through a withering rain of arrows. Get inside, get behind a barrel, and keep your head down. We cannot afford to lose you.
I finished spanning a second crossbow with shaky fingers and stopped, stunned at his comment.
Another crossbow would help, wouldn't it? I prefer to stay.
The captain shook his head.
you have as much chance of shooting one of our horses in the back of the head as an Imperial. Behind a barrel, now.
I slapped the devil's claw on the stock, harder than I meant to.
You know that's not true. I'm no marksman, but every bolt flying in their direction will help, correct?
Braylar thought about it for the briefest moment. A twitch smile later, he said.
Very well, but you will get behind the bench at least. We need to at least outfit you in a filthy gambeson if you continue to play hero, but for now, take some cover.
Then he spread the aventail of his helm out, slipped it up over his head so the mail draped across his shoulders, and strapped down the embattled shield on his left arm. The captain worked the leather lines again, manipulating the horses of the team with subtle movements as he got them moving again, and the rest of the convoy followed. As Braylar used the lines to communicate to the beasts, and we wound through the carts and cairns, several horsemen sped ahead, those in the very front with shields at the ready, and the second group armed with crossbows, presumably trusting their scale and lamellar cuirasses to be enough protection. We rode through the remainder of the buildings, picking up speed, and one or two townsfolk poked their heads out to watch us pass, but not so much as to present a target. That was an astoundingly good idea. I crawled over the bench, nearly racking myself as we rolled over a rut, and took position just behind the captain's shoulder. I built a quick tower of sacks of grain on one side and rolled a barrel onto the other. I expected a hail of arrows like those we experienced fleeing Sunrak, which proved entirely inadequate, as far as expectations went. The last of the buildings of crossthatch whipped past, and our wagon rattled over a short wooden bridge as we crossed a shallow ditch. And that's when I saw the war wagons ahead. They were impossible to miss, and as I looked over the top of the bench, I felt my breath catch. The Urglovians probably had fewer soldiers than we did, but they had erected what amounted to a fortress on wheels ahead. The wagons were chained end to end and created a long, insurmountable wall across the road. Each looked extremely heavy and sturdy, larger than our own, built of thick planks, tall, and they had an extra wall deployed to protect the wheels and gaps underneath on the broad sides facing us, and the section above had arrow loops. There must have been dozens of soldiers on platforms just on the other side, relatively protected, able to loose with impunity those wicked-looking composite bows. Several of the wagons also appeared to have ballistae as well, or some similar engine, just visible over the upper edge of the wooden walls. In the very small gaps between the wagons, I could make out some Urglovians wielding long spears, halberds, two-handed maces, and a number of other nasty weapons. There was absolutely no going through the wagons, and with the ground falling away in a ravine to the east and stony ground to the west, that left a relatively small alley that we had to pass through. The Urglovians didn't have enough wagons to blockade our entire path, but enough to make passage deadly. Braylar worked the leather lines in his hands and shouted encouragement to the horses, and we rolled forward at close to a gallop, making our way for that narrow, open space. A dozen or so horsemen veered off to the right, intent on trying to round the wagon fortress on the ravine side, or at least present more targets and draw arrows their way. I knelt and held the crossbow at the ready, hand away from the steel trigger until we got close enough for me to pick out a target that I would likely miss, cursing myself for not accepting the captain's offer to simply burrow beneath all the supplies we had and hope for the best. We were about 300 yards out when the first arrows arced over the top of the wagon wall, flying high in the sky. With the clouds dark and imposing, I lost the shafts in the gloom above us. But even with the creaking and rattling wagon and clamor of the horse's hooves, I heard the arrows as they came down. It was like an awful wind, and then I saw them again as they struck. Most hit the ground around us. A few slammed into shield faces or ricocheted off lamellar plates of soldiers ahead of us. But one horse was hit and slowed before continuing forward. Our horses were unharmed, but one arrow tore through the canvas above me and thudded into a barrel behind me. All of the Sildoon took aim as they galloped, loosed their bolts, and then spanned the crossbows again, almost without losing any speed at all. But the bolts were ineffectual, especially at that range, all striking the wooden walls of the war wagons or into the ground beyond. Another barrage of arrows was already flying, a little shallower as we had closed the gap, so I was able to see them a bit more clearly, which only made it worse, really. The ballistae shot their bolts as well, which were easy to track, as the missiles were nearly as long as a man was tall. The ones I saw flew between riders and disappeared, but they would not be deflected by armor or helm if they found a target. Then arrows hit everywhere at once. The ground on either side of our convoy, the road between riders, into several Sildoon themselves, although only one fell from the saddle that I saw. I heard a horse scream next to us, and the sound of canvas tearing again, this time right alongside me. An arrow ripped through and stuck into a sack to my right. I watched the grains start to trickle out and had to force my eyes forward. More arrows filled the sky, though again the trajectory was less parabolic. I rested the crossbow against the bench, sighted along the length, picked out an Erglovian, a lamellar, and a nasal helm standing between two wagons, took a deep breath, and loosed. Between the rocking wagon, the distance, and my own poor skills, there was little chance of hitting him. But I saw the bolt slam into the broadside of the wooden wagon not too far off, and hoped I at least startled someone. Then I ducked. Again the arrows rained among us, one striking the bench inches from my face, puncturing it, and spitting splinters into my hair. I scooted back as I picked up the other loaded crossbow, nearly discharged it as the terrain suddenly got bumpier and I flew off the floorboards. We left the road. I repositioned myself and tried to pick a target, and saw the majority of our company had veered as well. I expected us to slow, since the ground was less even, and I imagined we could break a horse's leg or shatter an axle or a wheel on one of the wagons, but we seemed to speed up, if anything. That's when I looked up and saw the arrow sticking out of Braylar's shoulder. It appeared to have penetrated the lamellar. Braylar turned and grabbed me by the arm.
"Loose another bolt or present a smaller target, but stop sightseeing, you shrunken cock!"
Only seeing his eyes in the helm, I couldn't tell how badly injured he was, but I did as commanded as the arrows fell again. This time, one striking the lead horse in the flank, two hitting the side of our wagon, and a third shredding canvas and landing inside somewhere. I cranked the lever back and was nearly finished reloading, when I looked at the war wagons, now much closer, and saw that arrows not only flew over their walls, but shot out of the loops in the broad sides. I aimed for one of those as best I could, squeezed the trigger, and fell behind the bench again to reload, this time being sure not to lean against it. I heard another scream just behind us, though couldn't be sure if it was human or animal, and Braylar cursed. When I looked back over the bench, I saw that one injured horse had fallen and crushed its rider, and another horse, wild with fear and pain, had reared and thrown the Sildoon from the saddle. Another soldier was struck square in the chest with a ballista bolt and flew backwards off the horse, the large bloody head sticking out of his back like a spear, having lanced him through and through. And then we rushed past those fallen. Several other riders were riddled with arrows. The arrows whizzed all around us, and it seemed a few more volleys would take out half our company before we even cleared the war wagons. Sofchian galloped past us on our right, arms stretched out, Rancer in one hand, fingers splayed in the other. But before she had a chance to perform any memory magic, an arrow struck her in the chest and ricocheted off, the shaft broken. But it had disturbed any concentration she needed, and it was everything she could do to keep herself in the saddle. I spanned and dropped the next bolt in as quickly as I could, rose above the bench,